This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is BreadboxMedia.com. Well, I'm back with you again. This is Chuck Coughlin. Sitting here before my microphone and my computer, my Mac, and looking out through this great window at this fantastic, beautiful sunny day, blue sky, miles and miles of Kentucky farmland stretching off in the distance. In the same kind of conformation you see in Tuscany. Well, unfortunately, Kentucky farm architecture doesn't quite come up to what you see in Tuscany. Oh, the Italians are geniuses, aren't they? Got a lot of barns on hilltops, so. I sometimes feel that I'm perched way up here, like in an eagle's nest, way up high. They call that an eyrie, an eagle's eyrie. Looking out over miles and miles of beautiful Kentucky, a rolling farmland. This isn't really the knobs. I call the farm windswept knob because the winds are so high around here. The knobs are actually a little to the south of me, but I love the term, so that's my conceit. This is Windswept Knob. Hope you've been listening to the two previous programs on the secret archives of the Vatican, because that will help you get into this show a little bit. There's going to be several more. It's such a fascinating subject. This is a treasure trove. I discovered a book in the UK library, the University of Kentucky Library, The Secret Archives of the Vatican by Maria Luisa Ambrosini with Mary Willis. It is a rather famous book. You can read the whole book online. Maria Luisa Ambrosini's book is really full of some colorful stories, as she described her main theme, which are the secret archives of the Vatican. And they weren't really secret. The word secret in that more ancient sense means private. It's the private library of the popes and is open to qualified scholars. So I'm drawing on Maria Luisa and some other sources, drawing a little bit on Will Durant and some other historians and some of my personal observations. So when we left the subject, Constantine was marching south along the Via Flaminia, bringing his troops of Celts and other wild men down to conquer Rome and take over, be the first Catholic emperor of Rome. And he was an interesting man. He was, an army brat. Now, all his life he'd been in the Mithraic religion. And the Mithraic religion, of course, was a rather harsh religion. It was sort of like a code of military justice. And Constantine's conversion, the moment of his conversion, is rather famous. One of the most famous of all history. Constantine rode at the head of his troops. And he saw a sign in the sky, the sign of Christ. And he saw the words, "In this sign, you will be victorious." It was in Latin, of course. "In hoc signo vinces," in this sign, you will be victorious. And so he had that sign put on the shields of his men and on his banners, and they marched into battle under that sign of Christ. It crossed the Milvian Bridge, and he was victorious that day, and in subsequent days, in battle after battle, under that sign. And Constantine, the great skeptic, became a believer. Constantine was converted. That's a rather famous thing. I'm sure you've heard of that. There's been debate as how much of a Catholic he was, but I come down on the side he was a pretty devout Catholic just because he was baptized on his deathbed. That was not uncommon at that time because of the remission of sins accompanies baptism. Constantine even referred to himself once as a bishop of those outside the church. He was certainly very reverent, and his gifts to the church indicated devotion and dedication. His gifts to the church included a large palace and three large basilicas. One the Laterna on the Celian Hill, one on Vatican Hill, and one dedicated to St. Paul outside the walls. But he wasn't just generous to the Catholic Church. No, no. Constantine was a very tolerant man. He was also generous to other religions, some of the pagan religions. He built temples to them and supported them. He was a man who, most of all, was virtuous and perhaps very proud of his virtue, but he was very virtuous and tolerant and generous. Now, he certainly had a dark side. We'll talk about that. Unlike his predecessors, Diocletian and all those terrible emperors like Nero that persecuted the Catholics, and much like the colony of Maryland in the New World, he was tolerant of all religion. The New World colonies, the 13 colonies, were 12 of them tremendously anti-Catholic and very intolerant of other than their established religions. The exception was the one named after our Blessed Mother, Maryland. The founders of Maryland, Calvert, Lord Baltimore, were Catholic and tolerant of other religions. You think about the gifts of Constantine of these palaces, like the Lantern and Palace. Fortunately, the palace had a history of violence, even murders. The owners had been the Laterani, but Nero had them executed. Now, Constantine was no Nero. He was a man of great virtue. But yes, Constantine had his dark side, because that palace was called the Palace of Fausta. That was his second wife, Fausta. According to one historian, Fausta accused her stepson, Crispus, of incest. Well, Constantine had him killed. Later, he became convinced, and he heard from reliable sources, that Crispus, his son, had been innocent. He had his wife strangled. Fausta was strangled. So he gave the palace of Fausta, Fausta sometimes is called Phaedra, to Pope Sylvester. And he probably had Constantine as a house guest while his own home was being built and prepared. It was quite a place. I'm laying a little foundation for my story, the archives here. He built the Lateran Palace, and at the same time, in the other end of town, he built St. Peter's, the largest of the basilicas, which had a silver altar studded with 400 precious stones. Now, the building site was on a steep hillside. That had to be sliced away and part of it built up to make a level place. He wanted a level place over the tomb of the Apostle Peter. Now, that was some strain since it was a cutaway hill filled in. It wasn't a good site. And that was a strain on the structure that led to the replacement of St. Peter's at the time of the Reformation. Despite that, it stood for 12 centuries, and it was a building of honesty and elegance. It was sort of a barn of a place. It was a place where even a modern man could feel at home. Behind the silver altar was the chair of St. Peter. In front of it, the choir with six columns that had come from the Temple of Jerusalem, of alabaster, twined with vine leaves. We know what a great archaeologist Helena, St. Helena, Constantine's mother was. Well, she brought those columns here from that temple in Jerusalem because a very strong tradition said that Christ leaned against those columns as he was teaching in the temple. Now, St. Peter still has one of these columns. You can go see it. It's located near the Pietà, Michelangelo's Pietà. Well, time went on, and Constantine was soon discovered that building basilicas for Catholics was a lot easier than governing them. He was sort of a typical army officer. He did staff studies, chose a solution, carried it through. But he allowed a surprising amount of democracy and self-determination to Catholics. But he wanted them to make up their minds. He was impatient with this constant bickering about the exact meaning of the Catholic tradition that Jesus Christ had left us. He said this, listen to Constantine, "Such is the regard that I pay to the lawful Catholic Church, that I desire to leave no schism or division anywhere." He thought that if men were united in regard to religion, quote, the conduct of public affairs would be considerably eased. So instead, councils were held, decisions were made, and the dissidents continued to dissent. His polite letters and ordinances don't conceal his conviction that the quarrels of the early Catholics were a lot of darn nonsense. There was one time that he dazzled them all into virtual agreement. That was the Council of Nicaea. And they formulated the Nicene Creed. The conference room was the hall of the palace. Constantine acted as chairman in the absence of Pope Sylvester, who was just too old to go to Nicaea. The bishops were there from all parts of the empire, and many of them carried on their bodies the scars of their persecutions. The Egyptian bishop wore a bandage over the socket of an eye that had been torn out at the time of the Emperor Maximin. And old Paul, bishop of New Caesarea of the Euphrates, had to be supported by his armpits. His hands were paralyzed, their tendons having been burned out with red-hot pincers. Constantine's manner toward the bishops was courteous and friendly, and at the banquet that closed the council, the fathers remarked that they already seemed to be in the kingdom of God. We know what was said in the discussions of the Council of Nicaea, but only from theological treatises and historical narratives. This is the matter of the archives. The reports that the papal delegates Vitus and Vincent brought home to Pope Sylvester and to the Pope's secret archives, the Pope's personal archives, have now been lost. Were lost long ago, along with a great mass of documentation that accumulated in the Church's era of prosperity before the barbarian invasions. We're going to take a little bit of a break now. I need to stretch my legs, maybe walk outside in the sunlight. Maybe I'll go out to the mailbox before I climb back up here to my eagle's nest, my eyrie high above the barn in the countryside, among the toppling towers of my books. This is BreadboxMedia.com. This is Chuck Coughlin, revealing the record and setting it straight about the secret archives of the Vatican.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. This is BreadboxMedia.com.